everybody. Welcome, welcome. After dinner, that was very good. I think for our prayer, you know the song, Take, Oh Take Me As I Am? Do enough of us know that? Take, oh take me as I am, summon out what I shall be, set your seal upon my heart, and live in me. Who's pretty good with notes? Is it kind of like, take, oh, take me as I am, summon out what I shall be, set your seal upon my heart, and live in me. Take, oh, take me as I am, summon out what I shall be, set your seal upon my heart, and live in me. Amen. Well, welcome. You had a pretty good day, some hikes, some classes, some naps, some meals. We're pretty lucky, aren't we? So good to see everybody. Let me introduce myself a little bit. Ruth, my wife Nancy is here. Anybody seen her yet? She works for Habitat for Humanity, and she's in the choir right now for rehearsal. And she's heard all this many times. and I'm a campus pastor at the University of Arizona. I've been doing that for 10 years. And parish ministry before then for 20 years. We were in Denver right before moving to Tucson in 2001. And lots of interests. Our avocations are the things that keep us sane, right? And we wouldn't want to do our avocations full time, but they give us other avenues, other spaces to be in, and they're important to me. And we all have things that we maybe would have been if we aren't what we are now. And those are the things that I and I was a drummer in a rock band in high school and college, and we thought we were really good because we could play loud. And we started to have girlfriends, and they didn't think that we were that good. So it kind of fizzled by the end of college years. But I get to play in our student band a little bit, and that's fun to keep that going. And a barber, my dad cut our hair when I was growing up, and we thought he did a lousy job. We really gave him grief. But I must have learned a little bit, so on Monday mornings, I give haircuts to homeless men at a soup kitchen in Tucson, 10 to 12 haircuts, and I do it incognito. They don't know I'm a pastor. I'm just Ron the barber, and it gives me a chance to de-roll, which pastors, you know, need to do once in a while, and to just kind of be with people that I wouldn't be with normally, and get to practice my Spanish, which is about a 102 level, even though I work hard. I like to say, I tell them, yo estudio mucho, pero aprendo muy despacio. I study much, but I learn very slowly. But it's nice to have these avocations. What we're going to talk about these next few days comes from some thinking that's going on in my faith journey. One resulted in a book, Abled Emerging, and I have a couple copies here, and there's some in the bookstore. And then I have another one coming out later this summer. And together is kind of what you're going to see this week. So that's what that's about. And what we're going to be talking about can be described as a relationship between Christianity and science. When I went to college, you know what this is? Gustavus Adolphus College, GAC. I was a humanities kind of person. I started out as a music major and thought I might want to be a band director, musical band director. But then when I felt the tug to go to seminary, I was able to switch to what they call a distributive major, which was basically five minors. So history, philosophy, psychology, religion, and music. Kind of a broad liberal arts background. And my advisor thought I should know something about the human condition. And so I was into the humanities. And I still am, and love to read politics, history, social sciences, biographies. I like to study the lives of the presidents. So I know a fair amount about all the presidents, and I just enjoy doing that. In fact, somebody throw out a president or a date, and I'll just tell you.
Howard Taft.
Howard Taft. William Howard Taft was 1909 to 1913. he came between Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. And he was our biggest president. He was fat. And Garfield was only president about 3 or 4 months in 1881. He was shot. But he didn't die of the gunshot wound. He died of the medical treatment. Yeah. And sticking fingers in his wounds and that kind of thing. So anyway, that's just a little hobby. I love to do that. But about 15, 16 years ago, I started to become really fascinated by the more natural sciences. It wasn't that way before, but I got interested in evolutionary biology and astronomy and geology, and just found myself really, really fascinated by those. And I've always thought that the humanities should kind of affect the way we perceive Christianity. But now I've been starting to let the sciences affect the way I perceive Christianity. And I feel like I've been fishing on one side of the boat for most of my life and catching this and that. But now I'm fishing on the other side of the boat, the deeper waters, and I've got so many fish that my theological nets are starting to tear. And it's exciting. I'm finding it to be an adventure in faith. I think we all have sort of, remember Zacchaeus? He needed a tree to see Jesus. I think we all need a tree to give us a different perspective. And right now, anyway, some of the natural sciences are my perspective. So we're going to be looking at this a little bit. And I've got some things to share. We're going to go on a little journey here. And afterwards, we'll do some Q&A and discussion. I'm suggesting these things. Some are a little radical. You may need your pastor to kind of fix you when you get back home, or if the pastor is here now. But this is sort of where I have been going lately. So that's what I'm sharing. So this is our first study here. So let's look at kind of the natural sciences a little bit. What's the highest mountain in the world?
Everest.
Well, it depends on, right. If you're from sea level to the top, it's Everest. Do you know what it is if you're from the bottom of the ocean to the top? Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And if you're from the center of the earth to the top, Mount Chimborazo in Ecuador. And one of the reasons is that the Earth is fatter at the equator. So from the center point of the Earth to the top. So things are not always what they seem. What's the largest river in the world?
Large.
Large, yeah. Well, it depends on, The Nile is the longest, but the Amazon is the largest. It's between 1 and 6 miles wide almost the whole time. 20% of the world's water that comes through a river system comes through the Amazon. It enters into the ocean. So it's huge and amazing. Okay, a cheetah can go 60 miles an hour. And every once in a while, for its lunch, it wants to have a gazelle that can only go 40 miles an hour. So who's going to kind of win this little narrative here?
Stan will help the gazelle.
Okay. Yeah. The cheetah can go 60 miles an hour, but only for 60 seconds. And then it is so tired that it almost is dangerously tired that if it didn't catch its food in those 60 seconds, it's going to be very hungry for a day or two. Because it doesn't have any stored energy in its tank. And a gazelle goes 40 miles an hour, but it can go forever. And a cheetah likes to go straight, and a gazelle can go this way. So it's just amazing in God's story of life, just the variety and the way things fit in and don't fit in, and it's such an amazing story. Anybody else have any kind of things that they've learned about the natural world that just really amazes them?
The total number of cells in our human body.
Which is about...
I don't know what the number is, but the percentage of those that are non... If we took all the living cells in what we consider to be our body, the total number of those cells that have human DNA, 10%.
Yep.
And 90% are...
Bacteria. Yep. Yep. That's right. It's incredible.
I remember a social worker talking to us while our son was in the NICU, and she said, the miracle of life is really that most babies are born with no problems, that don't need a NICU. The one founder is should have ever learned, but really, that the way God created it, that most babies are going to be just fine.
Yeah.
When one small adherence to the DNA chain.
Right. But you think about that, how unlikely it is that any of us are here. Take the number of eggs in a female, number of sperm in a male, and just those two happen to get together, and voila, we're here. And if mom and dad had not been amorous that night, that we would not be here. Which reminds me of a joke. You know why it takes 10 million sperm to fertilize one female egg? It's because men don't like to ask for directions. I think that's a Garrison Keillor joke. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, the story of life is amazing. Astronomy, Robin and I were talking about astronomy a little bit. We go outside tonight and look at the stars. We'll see some in this valley. And if we... I think we can see with the naked eye, like, I think it's 8,000 stars, roughly, that we need telescopes. And these stars are just all over, and of course a star is really a sun. So all the worlds are suns, and many of them have solar systems or planets evolving around them. And our galaxy, the Milky Way, has 200 billion of these solar systems. But then in the 1920s, Hubble, I believe, was the one who began to think that maybe there's even some galaxies outside of the Milky Way galaxy. And there aren't now just 2 or 3 or 8 or 10. There's about 2 billion other galaxies, some with 100,000 stars, some with 1 trillion stars. I mean, why did God make this world so big? And we're just one tiny little speck in one little arm of our particular galaxy. It's amazing. And not only is this vast, it's also ancient. If we were to look at the sun, and you don't want to do that, but if we were, what we are seeing is what began to come to Earth 8 minutes ago. That's how long it takes for an image to travel the speed of light, 93 million miles from the sun to Earth. So we're seeing what it looks like 8 minutes ago. The nearest star to ours, Proxima Centauri, is 4.2 light years away. That means that if we were, that's 24 trillion miles, to look at that star, we would not be seeing what that star looks like today. We'd be seeing what it looks like 4.2 years ago. And the nearest galaxy is 2.5 million years away. Again, look at that through his telescopes. We're not seeing how it is today. We're seeing how it is when someone pushed the send button 2.5 million years ago, and that image started traveling to us, and then it hits our eyes. So it kind of raises the question, with astronomy, are we able to look back in time? What do you think? We are. In fact, they've seen images from stars 13 billion light years away. So we don't even know if those stars or consortium of stars exist today. And they probably don't. That's sort of the common guess. But they did 13.7 billion years ago, and we're now seeing what it looked like back then. So God's story is not only vast, God is ancient. We lived in Denver for a while before moving to Tucson. Anybody been to Red Rocks and Garden of the Gods? I was amazed to learn when I moved there and started checking around in museums and places that the Rocky Mountains that we see today are the fourth mountain range that has risen up and eroded down and risen up and eroded down. This fourth one began rising up about 70 million years ago. And when it did, it started to push up red sedimentary rock from a previous mountain range, which is now exposed. And that's what Red Rocks is in the Garden of Gods. In fact, in Morrison, Colorado, just outside of Denver, anybody been to Dinosaur Ridge? You can actually see tracks of dinosaurs, and the feet are about this big, on kind of a slanted wall that before this mountain range, it's from a previous mountain range, a family of dinosaurs trekked through kind of a riverbed, and somehow they were able to fossilize those footprints. But then when this mountain range pushed up, it exposed them, so you can go there today and you can see those things, and you can put your hand in those. It's an amazing thing, that story of life. We lived in Buffalo, New York for a little while, and this is Niagara Falls. And not only is the earth the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and the universe is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, but in the Father's house there are many dwelling places. And we tend to think that verse from John 14 is talking about heaven. And maybe it is. But the Father's house is wherever the reign of God is. And so the whole universe is the Creator's house. And there are many dwelling places. And we get to occupy a few of those, our particular species. So the story of life is ancient and vast. Anybody want to make a comment or ask who raise a thought here at this time? Okay.
At the one time, it's very important to us, complex and important. Essential things are happening all around us. On the other hand, we put it into a context aspect. So, caught between those two realizations is what
Yeah.
I mean,
we could stand to chill out a little bit more, right? This is just a little bit of a timeline. 13.7 billion years, the universe begins, planet Earth begins, single cell life, 3.8 billion years ago. And notice how long it took to move from single cell to multiple cell life, which shows that that must have been quite a major transformation, where single entities learned how to cooperate and become multiple cells. 395 million years ago, sea life began to move onto the land. 295 million years ago, reptiles started to come. Mammals, about 195 million. And they were really tiny because the dinosaurs were along. And the dinosaurs went extinct about 65 million years ago. And that apparently opened up niches or space for some mammals to start to get bigger. And an interesting thing about 65 million years ago, I did not know this up until about 5 years ago. Maybe you guys all knew this, but apparently some mammals began to evolve back into the sea because there's common skeletal bone structure, physical features, and DNA between such land creatures like elephants and cattle and sea otters and wolves, and sea creatures like manatees, whales, dolphins, sea otters, seals. And the thought is that they were land animals that lived by the sea, and as millions of years they kind of evolved back into the sea, some of them. That's why there are mammals in the sea. And a mammal has to breathe. Some whales can go about an hour, but they have to come up for air. And when a baby whale is born underwater, runs to the surface and takes a gulp of air. Primates, about 20 million years ago, our predecessor species, Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, maybe 3 to 4 million years ago. Homo sapiens, that's what we are, about 200,000 years. And a more modern version, that this seems to be when symbolic thought and language seems to have come around, about 70 million years ago. So the story of life is vast, and the story of life is ancient. Yes?
I wonder if you're maybe going to comment about this, but the evolution seems to be going at, you know, in faster cycles. The gaps in among those years, between the years for change,
maybe,
are tightening and tightening, are they not?
I don't know. It could be. Any biologists here? It could be.
I think it's an interesting question. You go back 12,000 years, you can say, and we don't have a record to help us do that, but has the Homo sapiens changed that much,
right,
in our thought processes? Anyway, it's a question.
Yeah. How different are we from our ancestors 50,000 years ago?
The thing that spurs me very often is maybe Old Testament literature, and you start projecting motivations and stuff. So most people weren't a whole lot different than we were. So is evolution,
right,
does that stop?
Right.
Or is this just the whole idea of how we perceive this time gap?
Yeah.
Question. So those are just things that...
It's probably going on, but we
can't
see.
Social science perspectives, or, can we perceive it?
So in perspective too, like you look at chimpanzees or even some early primates, we share 97% of our DNA,
right,
is exactly identical. So the DNA, in fact, the DNA similarities between multiple cell life and ours is remarkably similar.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you look at how DNA has changed over the planet, actually, it's more linear.
Huh? And yet there's a capacity for variety. I mean, there's just so much variety. Eden was told not perfect. Remember in Genesis 1, God made the land, and behold, it was good. The Hebrew word is tov. Good. And then God made the plants, and behold, it was good. God made animals, and behold, it was good. And God made humans, and behold, they were good. I just learned this recently. Tov does not mean perfection. It doesn't mean paradise. It means good. Actually, the concept of perfection in paradise is a later Greco-Roman construct that was imposed backward into an earlier time, Hebrew time. And God made the world good, not perfect. So what does that mean? Eden, good, tov, means a lot of things. It means rain, wind, seasons, fungi. One of our students loves studying fungi. She comes and tells about that. And earthquakes. Earthquakes. God made the world with earthquakes? Well, apparently, earthquakes, you know, the tectonic plates are moving all the time. About 4 inches a year, they build up pressure, and then when it builds up enough pressure, it jerks, and that's an earthquake. Always moving. But it's part of a colossal circulation system. So the crust, which interacts with the elements of the atmosphere and the sun, energized by the sun, is then brought down into the molten, and other stuff comes up, and it's this huge, grand circulation system. In fact, scientists are pretty sure that if we did not have earthquakes, this would be a dead planet. There would be no life. So apparently, God made the world tov, and that includes earthquakes. Includes termites, snow and ice, uplift and erosion, lightning. Lightning apparently recharges the atmosphere and the soil with nitrogen and other chemicals, and it's part of the water cycle. Of course, if lightning hits you, it's a bad thing for your house or your neighbor's house. But in the bigger scheme of things, lightning apparently is very necessary for life to be here. Benjamin Franklin in the mid-1700s invented the lightning rod. Think about this. Humans have been around for 200,000 years, and it was only 250 years ago or whatever the math is, the lightning rod. And some people criticized Ben for doing that because he was messy with God's message delivery system. Because if you got struck, it's because you're doing something wrong. Photosynthesis, hurricanes. Hurricanes distribute the accumulated hot air around the equator belt to other parts of the globe. And hurricanes help to cross-pollinate various species from island to island to continent. Anybody read the book Hawaii, James Michener? First it was just a volcanic rock, Hawaii, and then some stuff floated over and began to take root, but it didn't quite make it and died out. And a few thousand years later, some more came over. I mean, this whole cross-pollination thing. Hurricanes, again, if it hits you or your neighbor, it's a bad thing. Eden includes evaporation, conductivity, bacteria. That's getting into Ben's comment there. We are filled with bacteria inside of us. Millions, millions of cells of bacteria. And on us. And we use some of that sanitizer. And out of the several billion, it kills maybe 60 or 70. Without that bacteria, we would be dead. Because it's 90% of us.
Nitrogen of ourselves.
Of ourselves. Somehow we, and this is true of all life, it's kind of evolved, commingling together. And it's just sort of an amazing, amazing thing. The food network, you know, would someone read this quote here?
At first, ecologists studied food chains, big fish eating little fish. Quickly they realized that since big fish die and are subsequently eaten by scavengers and microbes that are then eaten by still other organisms, it is more appropriate to speak of food cycles or webs. Further analysis yielded the insight that all of nature is continually engaged in the cycling and recycling of energy and matter. There are carbon cycles, nitrogen cycles, phosphorus cycles, sulfur cycles, and water cycles.
12 means a lot of things. Handles, sex, conductivity, youth, middle age, old age, viruses. I just read a book called Planet of Viruses. And we think of viruses as bad. And again, when they hit you, they are. But apparently, viruses are very necessary for the story of life. In fact, some even think they were even before bacteria. And they're a big reason why we have oxygen in this planet. So, God made forest fires, God made life, and God made death. Now, God made death? That's not what I learned in seminary, I don't think. But think about that. These are called gamble quail. They're in Arizona. And in the spring, these quail have about 14 babies. And about 11 of them become lunch for another, a lizard or an owl or another creature. And about 3 of them grow up and make some babies themselves. Well, what if all 14 grew up and made babies? Or what if none of them ever died? We would have a lot of gamble quail on this earth. You could say the same thing about the deer we see in winter. What if nothing ever died? The plants, the trees. We're hiking today and just seeing this amazing scene of pine trees decomposing and becoming soil again. And what if that didn't happen? The human population, you know that in 1902, this was the world's population. That's when Teddy Roosevelt took over from McKinley because McKinley got shot in Buffalo, New York. It took 200,000 years to get to 1.5 billion as far as species. In 60 years, it doubled. Kennedy was president. And in 50 years, it's more than doubled, so that it's 7 billion. And the projection, by the middle of the century, 9 billion. The end of the century, 13 billion. I mean, I don't know if the world can stand this many of us.
And yet, there is something happening, because even according to your figures, that rate's declining.
Okay. Maybe it's reaching some kind of limit. Could be.
I mean,
who knows?
What the demographers know.
Yeah. But again, what if nobody died? We would really have a lot of people. So, what I'm trying to get across here is the reign of God is vast, it's ancient. The Tov world, the good world that God has made, is amazing. And we get to be part of it. The story of life, we get to be a part of it. And look again at our species a little bit. And these dates are approximate. And there's no, they don't say, okay, at 200,000 years, now there's Homo sapiens. It's that around there appears to be a creature that has very similar characteristics to us, and it's called Homo sapiens. As you know, our Bible has some things about to say about this. We have two creation stories. Genesis 2 is the earlier creation story, I think. About 900 BCE, before Common Era. It's interesting that the Hebrew word Yahweh formed the Adam, the human creature, from the dust of the Adama, the soil. You can see a similarity there. Anybody ever been to the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago? Yeah, a wonderful, wonderful museum. They have a display there called Underground Adventure, where they have basically taken like a square foot of soil and blown it up 100 times and made this museum. And so you walk through there, and a worm that's normally an inch long is now 10 feet long, and a little mite that's marked microscopic is this big. And you just see all the life that's in soil. Martin Brokenleg was a professor, I think, at Augustana College in religious studies. Do you know him?
I was at a workshop with his years.
Okay, he's Lakota. And I heard him talk once, and he said, I just thought this was neat. He said, when I'm feeling kind of out of sorts and just discombobulated, in a state of existential disrepair, I don't watch TV. I don't even go to a counselor. I just lay down in the grass and be close to my family of origin, close to the soil. And I don't think he's talking anything sort of, whoa, spiritual or anything. Just close to the biological place where we came from. Now, I have no clue what the biblical stories meant, storytellers meant on this. I have no clue. And I haven't found anyone else that was either. But there's something about this Adam and Adama that certainly fits evolutionary biology. And those storytellers must have seen some connection to the rest of creation, to the earth. We also have another creation story in Genesis 1, and some very, very curious language. God said on the sixth day, let us make humankind in our image. Anybody know what us and our is? You ever wondered about that?
They're pronouns.
Okay.
Girl. Girl.
God in his heaven.
That's what I kind of learned, or maybe the Trinity, although the Hebrew folks wouldn't say that. Here's an idea that I suggest. And again, I have no clue what the storytellers were trying to get at. But you know, right before this, God had made all the animals. Maybe God's talking to the animals. Let us make humans in our image. And that we are made in the image of God and in the image of all other creatures on earth. And we forget either at our peril. And our problem is, we've forgotten one or both or the other. Now again, I don't know what they meant. But that interpretation to me kind of fits what I've been learning about evolutionary biology. Anybody have a reaction to that? I know it's kind of weird. It's not what I learned in seminary, that's for sure. Yeah.
How does that relate to pantheism, or does it?
Pantheism sort of means that this squirrel is God, or this bush is God. There's something else called panentheism, which means that God's presence is everywhere. And I guess I would buy into that.
Panentheism.
Yeah, panentheism. That's the right word, isn't it? Some of you would say that. Yeah. And I don't know if that's heretical or not. But I just see the reign of God permeating the creation. That's a different thing than pantheism.
Us strikes me too that there were other presences. We have no way of understanding. God may have not been the only presence. He may have been more all powerful in something. He may not have been more.
So, like other deities, you think?
I don't know. And he hasn't chosen to let us know that. So, we can guess all day at that, but that there could have been other.
I tend to feel it's just more earthy than that. God was looking at the other creature and said, okay, let's make this other creature our image.
What about the notion of God is can't help himself from creating? You're a being.
It's in his nature to be creative.
That which has dragon has great potential for us is Christians. We should be building relationships, realities, rather than destroying them. Although there's times when destruction, like he was talking about death.
Yeah.
Death didn't occur. This was part of that cycle, so that secular thing is strong. It wasn't just bored on a Saturday.
Right.
One of my avocations is animals. And we have chickens and we have golden retrievers. And we always have this blessing of the animals. But just relating to them and the birds and watching them, these books that have come out now that shows these different species all taking care of each other and their, and the reaction of mother animals when they take the babies away from them. You know, I think that we've done so much to harm animals. Because we think they're just nothing.
You're leading them to where I'm going. Yeah. As humans, we're an interesting species. We're developed in many, many ways. But we're also underdeveloped in some ways, too. Cannot fly or live under the sea, let alone fly backward and upside down like a hummingbird. We're clumsy on our feet compared to a mountain goat or mule. We have terrible hand-eye coordination compared to a squirrel. We rank in the middle in terms of speed, faster than cows, slower than pumas. And runners here, faster than pumas.
Yes, they don't call shoes cows.
We cannot change our color. Suntan, I guess, but it takes a while. Cannot store water. And yet, we're doing fine. God's given us what we need. As God has given every species what we need. And of course, new species have emerged since our arrival, too. And that's important to know that the evolving story of life just continues. So God's evolving story, and God's reign is vast, and God's reign is ancient. The earth is the Lord's, the fullness thereof, the Father's house has many dwelling places. And we just know one tiny little speck of it, and one tiny little planet. Someone read that?
You visit the earth and water it, greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide people with grain, for so you can prepare it. The pastures of the wilderness overflow. The hills gird themselves with joy. the meadows, clothe themselves with flocks, valleys deck themselves with grain. They shout and sing together with joy.
This is our garden. Our neighbor is enjoying our tomatoes right now. But he's watering those. We have a tank there, we harvest water.
Oh my.
Love your
toys.
No. So I have a question. Three questions, actually. Ever wondered why Judaism and Christianity are so elusive? Look at that. This whole reign of God, this story of life. And these guys are 4,000 to 2,000 years old.
What about some of the Asian religions? Were some of them older?
Yeah. I think so. I think in fact, there's evidence, I don't know, like religions maybe 40, 50,000 years ago in some cave paintings, you know. It seemed to indicate some religious something going on.
That doesn't get me, because out of 13 billion years, whether it's 10,000 or 50,000, it's still spit. I mean, it's not
very long. Not very long.
So in, as far as that compares, what it could have, what could develop a religious system for, we'll see, if we talk about the ability. Trying to understand what it means for oneself and the virus for bacteria that we perceive it. So I'm not disagreeing.
Right.
I'm saying that in some ways that doesn't bother me a lot.
Okay. Well, I wonder that.
You know, what does bother me is that our theology is so Judeo-Christian centric that we think that it all began with us. And that bothers me tremendously.
That's where we're kind of going.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second question is, you ever wondered why not only are these religions recent, but the kind of the core message, I think, is the reign of God, the kingdom of God. And have you ever wondered why that message is addressed to our particular species? So, I'm going to tell you the answer to these questions. And the answer is, I don't know. But, I have a theory to suggest for your consideration. And that's what we're going to kind of be doing this week. And the theory is this. After a couple hundred thousand years as a species, and 70,000 years as modern human species, fairly recently, our species began to go nuts. In the form of, if you can imagine, tens of thousands of human cultures around the planet. Some of those began to adopt a new narrative. And the new narrative, I'm suggesting, was this. Rather than God's earth, the creator's earth, or the earth, or the community of life being belonging to the whole community of life, including us, the new narrative, I'm suggesting, and Greg knows this from, anybody read Daniel Quinn stuff? Ishmael, I think. The new narrative switched from this to Earth belongs to the whole community, like we're part of it, we're one of the species that's part of it, we get to be here, changed to, it's all about us. Sometimes called human exceptionalism. Humans are special. We're more special than all of the creatures. In fact, we're more special than all of the creatures put together. Humans are separate from, superior to, the reason for, and the rulers of the rest of the creation. Suggesting that this worldview began to take hold so that now, today, it is the dominant narrative of our species. It's the air we breathe 24/7 and the airwaves that we listen to 24/7. Pythagoras summed it up this way: man is the measure of all things, root of a yardstick. Someone want to read Francis's thought?
Man, if you look to final causes, may be regarded as the center of the world, insomuch that if man were taken away from the world, the rest would seem to be all astray, without aim or purpose.
And there's other expressions of that through history. I'm suggesting that this has become the dominant narrative of our species. Our culture, certainly, but many other cultures around the world. And as we began to live that narrative, we became a conquistador towards not only each other, but towards God's creation. We became a dominator rather than a participant. We became a taker.
In answer to your earlier question, as I can quote that, I guess, the reason of sin. So the reason Judaism and Christianity become the markers is they mark where that rebellion started.
You caught where I'm going. Perfect. The creed of this new way of thinking. Would someone read this?
The world is a jungle, a dangerous, deficient, defiant, disorderly enemy. It is wild and needs to be tamed. Broken and needs to be fixed, inept and needs to be conquered, a wasteland and needs to be developed.
So then what I'm suggesting is that this sort of new worldview started to infiltrate our species and start to spread. So I'm suggesting that this might be what the fall story is about. If you can imagine our species being around for 200,000 years, populating thousands of cultures around the world, 9,000 years ago, some of those isolated cultures started to adopt this new way of thinking. And maybe about 3,000 years ago, those folks started to come into the neighborhood of these storytellers. And they started to notice these people who were coming around and wondering, what's wrong with these people? They seem to be living as though they think the world revolves around them. They seem to think that they are separate from the creation, superior to the creation, the rulers of the creation, and the reason for the creation.
Well, maybe that they ask the creation question, which is filled up. Grand metaphysical question: why are we here? What are we doing? Where are we going?
Oh yeah, that's a big part of it too.
It rises to that point.
Yeah,
that we became civilized enough to ask that question, which is more than language.
Right. So what I'm suggesting for you to think about is that maybe these stories. One of the things that Daniel Quinn proposes is that the Adam and Eve stories are not historical, in that there were two people named Adam and Eve who had sex with each other and then had kids and they had sex with each other, and that's how the myth was populated. But also that they're not just symbolic. that they're not just stories kind of talking about what humans are like through all time. Rather, these stories are addressing historical changes that the storytellers are experiencing, and they create parables to try to make sense of it. What's wrong with these people? Well, maybe they've eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Maybe they think because they've eaten of this, they're wise. And maybe they think they are like God. So the stories are meant to address something that was happening in that neck of the woods and put into parable form, describing a change in our species that the storytellers were not happy about. And they believed God was not happy about. Yeah?
I'm just trying to sort this out.
Yes. So
wouldn't we be able to find evidence, though, of like seriously imperialistic, kind of violently slave-based manufactured societies well before when the policy was given? We could find, right?
Is there evidence, or have there been societies that were that way?
Right.
Domineering?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But I guess what I'm suggesting to think about is that even when those societies emerged, they were still part of the norm for our species, the rest of the cultures were kind of a checks and balances on that way of thinking. And then it just started to gain more and more traction, so that now the former way is mostly destroyed and the new way is the norm. And let me just say a couple things here. Another way to say this is that we left the Creator's house and God's reign. It was there for the sake of the whole community life, including humans and citizens. And instead declared our house and our reign. The reign of humans has come. Look out and be our way. And because that way of living started to take root, those cultures became more and more out of relationship. Became more and more out of relationship with creation. So rather than seeing themselves as, you know, part of creation, they saw themselves as separate from it. Started to grow out of relationship more and more with our neighbor. Now, that doesn't mean that previous peoples didn't have fights and skirmishes and all those kind of things too. But it escalated by degrees. We grew more and more out of relationship with our own inner spirit and soul and self. Kind of lived lives disconnected from even who we are. And more out of relationship with God.
He just has a godly voice.
He does.
And demeanor.
He began to be perishing. Daniel Quinn calls this a way of living that is connected with the creation and with our neighbor and with our inner spirit and with God. He calls that Abel, the Cain and Abel story. He calls it lever living. You take what you need and you leave the rest. Take what you need, leave the rest. He calls the new way of thinking Cain. Cain is a taker. Cain takes, and then takes some more, and then takes some more. He doesn't even understand the concept of leaving. If it's there, if I don't take it, someone else will. So it might not be there tomorrow. And that's why the book is called Able Emerging. It is trying to rediscover this relationship way of living in the world. It uses that story as a background template. It's not necessarily about that story, the King of Evil story.